time, so I'm happy to be here. This work was done with Son originally here some time ago, and then we sort of came up with a better version of it with Simon Caron Huo and Paul Chesler, and that's progressing, okay? Slow and steady. All right, so I know that everyone here doesn't work on ADS-CFT, and that's a good thing because most of the time I don't either. So I hope this will be accessible talk. Okay, so, but most of the time I work on, the relativistic heavy ion collider, which is how I came to get involved with ADS-CFT. And so I'd like to just spend a few seconds to kind of tell you kind of what some very important data that came out of the relativistic heavy ion collider, and sort of how I came to talk about ADS-CFT, okay, was through this data. So, all right, so first things, okay, so the two nuclei are Lorentz contracted factor 100. They're like pancakes. They collide, and they leave this hot region over there. And if there's any pressure gradients by this collision, then there's more pressure this way, stronger pressure gradient this way than that way, and that would lead then to an anisotropy. In it, the material would expand preferentially this way as opposed to that way, and that would lead to this momentum anisotropy. Okay, and we call that V2. It's a large number. It's 20%. You can't avoid it, okay? And the interpretation of this is that this heavy ion material does respond as a fluid in pressure differences in the x and y direction. Okay, basically, if you try and simulate this with kinetic theory, unless the mean free path is of order of the temperature, there's no way you will get even close to the measured elliptic flow. Okay, so the mean free path in this material is of order the h bar over the temperature, and that's essentially a strongly coupled material medium. Okay. Whether you can address that with resum perturbation theory is unclear, but at least it is certainly strongly coupled.
So we should take it for granted there's a temperature.
You should take it. I would say this evidence, this data is actually quite convincing. Okay, and in order, it's a large correlation amongst all of the particles, which acts over large distances, and so it's hard to get it by any other way, except through hydrodynamics. Okay, so you need a coordinated response over the size of the nucleus that's large compared to lambda QCD. It's really hard to see any other mechanism. Okay, and so this data really does indicate that the need for hydrodynamics and the need for temperature. All right, so I just show some data here. I mean, just this was my point here. It grows with momentum and then eventually levels out. And so it's a huge effect. I mean, if I look, the definition of V2, if I look at the particle distribution, is 1 plus 2V2. And V2 is like 0.2 up here. So 1 plus 2V2 is 0.4, 1 minus 0.4. And so you see that the ratio in this momentum range of particles going in the x relative to the y direction is nearly 2 to 1. Okay, so it's an enormous correlation which you can't ignore. Okay, so the other data I'd like to talk about is this energy loss of partons. Okay, so if you have fast partons, the initial spectrum in the PP event is, of course, a power law, right? And, of course, the equilibrium spectrum is very far from a power law. It's an exponential, okay? So the basic idea of studying energy loss of fast particles is that, you know, this power law spectrum will approach this exponential spectrum. Okay. And so there was a lot of data on that. Okay, so let me go here. And this is what this plot shows is the ratio of the yield of high PT particles in gold-gold relative to a scaled-up version of the of proton-proton events. And what you see is that there's this factor of 5 suppression of this leading hadrons relative to PP events. Okay, so this perturbative predictions work reasonably well out here at 8, 9, 10 GeV. And in gold-gold events, you get this factor of 5 suppression. Okay, so last bit of data I'd like to just tell everybody about is the energy loss of heavy quarks. Okay, so...
Sorry, slow you down.
Yeah. Yeah, so you could worry that maybe it's due to the nuclear shadowing, right? So if you said had, the structure functions are not exactly the same in nuclei as they are in protons, and so you could worry that that some of this suppression is due to shadowing, nuclear shadowing. And so by measuring deuter and gold, you can get a handle on that, because of course that you have one of the initial state is a nucleus. Okay. You can also look at direct photons, and they also shouldn't show any suppression. And indeed they don't. Okay, so if you plot the RAA of direct photons, you also see that they're about 1. So all of those things sort of convince you that you're not being cheated somehow by the complexity of the heavy ion event.
Is there going to be similar benchmarks on LHC?
No, and that's a problem. Yeah, that's a big problem. Yeah, not for a long time, because first they'll do AA, and then, of course, they'll look for the Higgs, and eventually, maybe sometime in 2020, right, they'll run proton nucleus or something like that. So that's a problem, big problem. You sort of have to look for other things in order to calibrate and make sure that there's no modifications of nuclear structure factors. Okay.
Since we said LHC, do you want to comment on their PP?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't want to. Okay. So the other last bit of data I wanted to talk about was the heavy quark data. So if you have a heavy quark and you place it into plasma, it will show Brownian motion, random walk of these heavy quarks. And depending on the relaxation rates of this heavy quark spectrum, this heavy quark will either relax to the underlying to the thermal spectrum and show the same flow as all the other particles, or not, depending on what is the drag or diffusion coefficients of those heavy particles. Okay, so it would be great if you could measure a low momentum or B quarks and do a beautiful job of measuring the those low momentum heavy particles. In fact, it doesn't work like that. Okay, the momentum are significantly larger than typical. Okay, and so you have to model that. Okay, so as you go up in momentum, of course, this notion of drag and diffusion in Brownian motion is not necessarily the right concept, okay? And so you can extrapolate that picture, but it's not guaranteed to be right. Okay, what I will show is this data. Okay, so here shows this RAA we discussed. It's the ratio between gold-gold and PP. And this is for the electrons from heavy flavor decays. So if you have a heavy quark, decay or heavy meson decays into an electron. And what you see is even for this heavy quarks, there's a substantial suppression of heavy flavor production. And what you also see is that even this heavy flavors show a significant elliptic flow. So those heavy quarks actually are responding to the gradients in the geometry and are actually being pushed along with the medium, okay? And, okay, so now you can try and model that, and no one is very successful. So this data is from the decay of the electron from a heavy meson. Essentially, no model reproduces the trends that are observed in the data. The data, I would say, is a complicated measurement. I mean, it's the decay electron. There's an enormous background. You subtract that, and you're left with something small, and that's what we're plotting here. Other complicated, So it's quite a lot of complications. Another complication is, which will be resolved, is that these electrons are due from both decay of charm and bottom. And so there's a mixture of charm and bottom, which in principle isn't a huge problem, but from a theoretical perspective, you know, the difference between charm and bottom is night and day, right? I mean, the bottom is this bowling ball, relativistic bowling ball. It can't be stopped in the plasma, and it's sort of very difficult to slow it down or even imagine that the bottom quark would have some elliptic flow. Okay, so going forward, experiments will sort out that difference between charm and bottom. Okay. Now, but anyway, if you're going to get anywhere close to the measured suppression of the heavy flavor data, you need a diffusion coefficient, which is again of order 1 over the temperature, h bar over the temperature. So no, that's not a weakly coupled regime when the transport mean free path is of order the h bar over temperature. Okay. So if you're going, so there's a lot, so let me try and summarize that data, what I said there. Okay, so there's sort of plenty of evidence that mean free paths are of order 1 over the temperature. Okay, there's this elliptic flow. The soft event of the heavy ion event is very different from a PP event, strongly modified. There's this significant energy loss, which is, you know, you have to explain. And also there's these heavy quarks, which are suppressed and flowing. Okay, so you know, now you say, what do you do about that? You're in a semi-strongly coupled regime. One strategy would be to do perturbation theories of various sorts, try and resum perturbation theory, which is a good thing to do. Of course, several years ago, I said, well, why don't we try to calculate something with ADS-CFT? I wouldn't claim that ADS-CFT, you know, explains the RIC data, but it's good fun, and I enjoyed it a lot, and actually start to get interested in its own right. Okay, so even outside of the interpretation of heavy ion data, it has some interesting features, okay, which I'll tell you about today.
And that's not that ratio is no longer a relevant expansion parameter for anything you're doing, right? Because you have these other scales.
The temperature is of order lambda QCD 2. So
is that what you mean? You mean that
mass is large compared to temperature. Right. And certainly for the bottom quark, that's wildly true. Right.
So that does give you a relevant expansion.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. So for the charm quark, debatable, it's kind of the peak of the Boltzmann distribution is 3 times the temperature. And so, you know, you're talking 600 MeV compared to the charm mass. It's not a huge expansion parameter. But for the bottom quark, it is a good approximation to treat it as very heavy. Okay. Okay, so now come to ADS-CFT. All right, so a couple years ago, I and a couple other people calculated the drag of a heavy quark in ADS-CFT. You find that the drag is proportional to the strong coupling, the square root of the Tuff coupling. Okay. And since the Tuff coupling is large, okay, this is a large number. Okay. Okay. Let's just sort of review in ADS-CFT how you calculate this drag. Okay. So what you do in the context of ADS-CFT is you pull along a string with constant velocity in the black hole geometry of ADS-5, and inside of this black hole, you solve the equations of motion for this classical string, and the string sort of trails down behind the quark. And if you look at the flow of momentum down the string and calculate this momentum flow down the string, you can see that a certain amount of momentum is lost per unit time, and that's equal to this rate. Okay, this shape is, let me just orient you for ADS-CFT. So here's this, the horizon, as for me, always at 1. This quantity is the stretched horizon, okay, which we'll talk about a little bit, which is a little bit displaced from the horizon at 1 plus epsilon. And up here is the quark mass, okay, which is our world. All right, so if you solve then this classical equations of motion for the string, you know, you just go solve this equations of motion in this ADS geometry, what happens is the string sort of slows down, slows down, slows down, and classically, it just comes to a stop. Okay, so it just slows down here and eventually becomes a straight string just sitting there if I just go solve the equations of motion in ADS 5. Now, okay, so that is clearly not the dual of a equilibrated quark in plasma. Okay, so if I take a quark in plasma, it should sort of wander around and show Brownian motion, okay, the way it's supposed to. And that would be the dual of a heavy quark. Okay, so clearly at the classical level, you're missing something about the dynamics of this quark. And let's just sort of say what you're missing, okay? What you're missing is there's no Hawking radiation, okay, which should come out of this black hole and cause this string to start to fluctuate in certain ways, okay? And if you work out how this Hawking radiation comes out, it should show up as a noise term, okay? And then when you put in the Hawking radiation together with the classical motion, you should recover this Brownian motion, sort of Langevin. You have a drag and a noise, and the two are balanced. Okay, maybe we just pause here for a second to reflect on why they're balanced, okay? So why is this drag and noise balanced? So, of course, the point is this only slows you down, right? Just drags you down into nothingness. And the noise is needed to speed you up again so that you reach the two equilibrium. And if you didn't have this relationship, right, between the drag and the noise, and sort of things kicking you and things slowing down, you would never reach equilibrium. And so that the reason why the noise is balanced just like that is so that you reach equilibrium. Okay. So in the context of ADS CFT, I missed that basic thing, okay, that there's, you know, things slowing you down, but there's got to be something speeding you up, right, which keeps you going and keeps you speeding up. And the two need to be just exactly balanced so that you come into some sort of equilibrium, okay? So where is the Hawking radiation in ADS CFT? Now, then that brings me to the other subject of Hawking radiation. So basically, you know, I read about Hawking radiation, and I find it extremely confusing. I find most of the discussions quite confusing. And they always involve some, Kruskal mixture of modes or some mixture of modes that you analytically continue in some funny way. And that seems to, miss some simple physics, which, you know, I'd like to sort of discuss today, okay? So that's what I'll do after I finish this. I'd like to give a different derivation of Hawking radiation than I've seen in the literature, which I think is good, okay? And furthermore, I think that one of the things, the goals with Simon Carreau was to sort of, how would you calculate Hawking radiation in out-of-equilibrium settings? Suppose the geometry is collapsing, the black hole is collapsing. How would you calculate that Hawking radiation? How would you set that up numerically? Never been done. Okay, seems to be funny that such a great celebrated effect should never be generalized out of equilibrium. Okay. At least I'm not aware if it's been done. Maybe it has. Okay, so so that's my goals today, to sort of show where the Hawking radiation is, give a different derivation of it, which generalizes out of equilibrium. So first, let's just review a little bit about Brownian motion. Okay, so very much it's all about deriving Brownian motion. Okay. All right, so if I have some density matrix, it's a matrix, right? So it has both an amplitude and a conjugate amplitude. And so if I then rewrite what this density matrix is in terms of the path integral, there's a path integral that goes in the forward direction along the Schwinger-Keldysh contour, and a path integral that goes in the backward direction, along the backward direction of the contour. And then finally, there's a trace over the initial density matrix. Okay. So if I have a heavy particle coupled to a bath of forces, right, I would write down a path integral of this particle. It's an integral over the bath with the path integral. The x1 is the amplitude, and the x2 is the conjugate amplitude. Okay. Now, this algebraic structure of the Schwinger-Keldysh contour leads sort of naturally to Brownian motion. And I'd like to just sort of review that. All right. So first of all, you have these different forces here on the contour. And these different forces, all right, so if I look at the correlation function of 1-1, one-type force and a one-type force, that's the time-ordered product of forces. Similarly, if I look at like 2-1, that would be the correlation of 1 and 2, which would be sort of an unordered product of time-ordered product of forces. Okay, so it's just a, there's no time-ordered product there. It just the time ordering is as written. Okay. Similarly, if I look at 2-2, that would be the anti-chronologically ordered product of forces. Okay, so this Schwinger-Keldysh thing, you know, is basically just a fact, just keeping track of all the different possible time orderings. All right. So I would venture that the Schwinger-Keldysh has in this form has never been useful. Okay. So anyone who ever wants to do an original calculation immediately switches to what's called the RA basis. Okay. So if you think about it, and it's very natural in a classical limit. Okay. So if you think about the classical motion or quasi-classical motion of the quark, then the amplitude is always very close to the conjugate amplitude, right? So this amplitude is always close in a classical limit, the conjugate amplitude. So it makes sense to look at this x, the average of the amplitude and the conjugate amplitude, that's the r, and the difference between the amplitude and the conjugate amplitude, which is xa. And xa is small. It's a small parameter. And indeed, you can do systematic power accounting in h bar, and that's just keeping tracks of a, of xa. Okay, roughly speaking, the classical limit without any thermal noise is 1 power of xa, and the including thermal noise or quantum fluctuations would be 2 powers of xa. And so that's going to be the goal here, generally in ADS 5. Okay, so once you write this thing, the action was odd, and so it must have just 1 power here of xa, like that originally. But once you integrate out the bath, right, then you get different, oh, I'm skipping ahead a little bit. So these correlation functions between, now I have fr and fa, which is also like 1 and 2. And these correlation functions, like f, the correlation of fr with fa, turns out to be the retarded one, right? And the correlation function of fr with fr turns out to be the symmetrized correlation function, okay, which you can just use by rewriting, knowing that the 1-1 was the chronological product and so on. Okay. Now, okay, so generally, you know, in equilibrium, these two functions are not unrelated. They're related by this fluctuation dissipation theorem, okay, which states that, you know, the symmetrized product is related to a thermal product of the imaginary part times the imaginary part of the retarded Green's function. Okay, so this is a fundamental theorem of statistical mechanics, fluctuation dissipation theorem. You can show that it's exactly identical to requiring that the noise be balancing the drag. Okay, and it's just a statement that the density matrix is e to the minus beta h. All right, so how do we show then that this statement is basically the same as requiring that the noise and the drag be the same? Okay, so this is a step which are sort of known, and I'd like to generalize this set of steps to ADS 5. Okay, so if I look at the partition function of a heavy quark, right, and I expand it out to quadratic order, then to quadratic order, it must have this form, okay? So just take this term, expand out this. These terms are small because compared to the inertial term, and so you expand it out and re-exponentiate, and you get the form of the classical effective action must have this functional form. Okay, that's all there is. That's just the general form of it. Maybe I write it down for later. So is equal to minus. All right, so it has to have this form to quadratic order. That's all there is, okay? And so the general, once you say that it must have this form and that G sim is related to GR, you sort of immediately cover this Brownian motion. And the way that's traditionally done is take this Gaussian, it's a Gaussian in this XA, a Gaussian, you rewrite it as this Gaussian is a Fourier transform of another Gaussian, okay, with some additional field here, C. And then once you do that, then every term in this integral is linear in XA. And you can then just do all the integrals over XA, and you get that the partition function is a functional like this, okay? So this is a delta function, and this is nothing else but your Brownian equation of motion with a certain definite noise, and the noise is related to this G sim. All right, so, well, anyway.
What's that mean? You can play your action here. Semi-perfect approximation.
Yeah, so, I mean, to get from there. Yeah. So what you do is you say, this term is heavy, right? So the force terms are small compared to the inertial terms. And so now I can start expanding those out to first, say, each one to quadratic order, right? And then each time, and now I keep those terms which grow with time, and then I can re-exponentiate those terms, and then you'll be left with this. You can already see that. I mean, this is, if I just take the first term in this expression and lower it down, it's just the expansion of those forces as you go down, okay? And then you re-exponentiate. Okay. Good. So the point is that, you know, this Brownian motion is sort of built into the Schwinger-Kelder structure very deeply, okay? All right, so this equation of motion, if I rewrite it in coordinate space, is equation of motion, it's traditional Brownian motion. So you have the equation of motion of the quark, has a drag piece involving the retarded propagator and the noise. This retarded propagator and the noise propagator are related by this fluctuation dissipation theorem. All right, good. So now essentially what we want to do is do the same thing in ADS 5, you know, rather than instead of just including one power of XA, which is the classical limit, we want to include two powers of XA and work out the form of the fluctuations in ADS 5. So here comes ADS-DFT. All right, so if I have, so I have my string. My string is initially straight, and I now consider small fluctuations around this string. Okay, the action of the string is quadratic fluctuations, has this form, right? It sort of has kind of traditional string action, right, that you learn in freshman physics. Well, that I'm teaching in freshman physics, okay? So it just sort of has two derivatives r and two derivatives x. This term is the tension in the string. This is the mass. Okay, in ADS 5, of course, you're in this curved geometry, and the tension depends on where you are in this thing, okay? And it turns out to have this particular form. It's proportional to this function f. F is, I should have written that down. So the metric of ADS 5. I'm happy to figure. Yeah, it's just linearized. Just the DBI action linearized around a straight string. So that's the only thing. So just take this straight string, linearize it, and you get this small equations for small fluctuations. Okay, good. All right, so you know here you find when you go solve the equations of motion near this horizon, you have sort of two solutions, one of which is infalling, and the other one is outgoing. And classically, you would normally say that nothing should come out of the black hole, and you've got this minus sign. All right. Now, so I interpreted that solution. I'd like to interpret that infalling boundary condition. Okay, so this infalling solution has a simple interpretation. Okay, so near the horizon, if I look at this solution, it's this infalling form of typical to ADS-C of T. And what you notice is if you multiply by R minus 1 times the derivative of this, you get here the time derivative of the coordinate at the horizon, okay? And so if I now here's how you could kind of guess the answer, okay? So if I kind of multiply it, look at this relation, stare at it a while, and realize that if I multiply by a constant, then I see this that this infalling boundary condition can be written like this. It's the tension times the derivative of this string is equal to the drag coefficient that was computed earlier times the motion of the horizon endpoint. Okay, so what that says is that this infalling boundary condition means the following: that you have a force pulling upward, you know, pulling you one way. That's the tension, and the motion of the horizon is exactly canceled by the drag. Okay, this eta x dot is exactly canceled by the drag. And so you get it here, the motion is over damped. There's sort of no acceleration right near the horizon. Just pull on this string, and you get a balance of forces. The drag exactly equals the applied force. All right. So, you know, that being said, yeah, you're missing, it's clear what you're missing here, right? So you have tension and drag. What you're missing there is noise, okay? So where is the noise? And basically, the rest, you know, some of the rest of the discussion is to claim that you should add a noise term here, which should obey this fluctuation dissipation theorem, that it should be related to, you know, the drag by 2t eta. Okay. All right. So now we got to do it, right? How to do it and so on. All right. So the basic strategy is we want to look at this stretched horizon. We want to integrate out the fluctuations below the stretched horizon. So you have this string, it's fluctuating, has all these fluctuations down here. And you want to integrate out all those fluctuations and get an effective action and an equation of motion for this horizon action, okay, for this horizon endpoint. So x is right here, and I want to find an action which summarizes the dynamics below this line. All right. So classically, this goes, people do this all the time, right? This goes under the name of the membrane paradigm, right? So classically, we can use this membrane paradigm and figure out what the classical effective action is here. All right. So... All right, so classically, this is the classical membrane paradigm. You have an action outside of this stretched horizon, which is called S out. You have an action inside, which is called S in. And then what you do is you add and subtract an action which is supposed to summarize this horizon dynamic. So you add horizon piece and subtract the same thing. And now you vary the pieces, okay, S out and S horizon, and S in, and S horizon. And you're going to choose this horizon action so that the individual pieces, the in and the out, are separately minimized. Okay. And that's generally how people constructed this membrane paradigm for black holes. All right, so now we do it. Okay, so you have this horizon. Let's look at the in part. You have in minus the horizon. This is the action inside. And then you subtract this thing. So now once I vary with respect to this XA, I get the equation of the motion inside of the bulk. And I get this term on the horizon, which says that the tension times this derivative, right, has to be equal to the derivative of S with respect to XA. Okay. So now if I know, but since I now I'm supposed to go find this horizon action, and the way you do that is you first solve this equation, this tension time, you know, this bulk equation. And of course, since we're right near the horizon, this solution is given by this form. I mean, it's the near horizon solution, it's the infalling solution. And so if I then take the derivative of this solution, as I already discussed, I mean, if I just take this derivative, I know what it is. I take the tension here, take the derivative of x, and I get minus I omega eta times x, right? And if I now compare, you know, this minus I omega eta times x with this form, yeah, then I conclude that the horizon action to quadratic order must have this form, right? So it must have, you know, omega this xa and the minus I omega xr. All right, so now I come here and I look, all right, and I sort of can guess what the natural general quantum generalization is. Okay, so I look here at this horizon of effective action. I see that xa and xr, the linear piece in xa, which is the classical piece, and to get the quadratic piece, I should add this term. Okay, and so the Hawking flux will give you that if once you calculate it. Okay. All right. So now you can guess. Okay. So I will guess the horizon effective action. We didn't guess it in our paper, so derived it in a complicated way, but it's possible. It would have been possible to guess a posteriori. Okay. All right. So we'd say that the horizon action at a quantum level must have this form. It must have this retarded piece, the symmetrized piece. And if Hawking didn't lie to us and black holes are really thermal, this symmetrized piece must be determined by this retarded piece. Okay. All right. So now once you do that, all is good. You can essentially go through the same steps. I mean, here was my horizon action, and here's my string partition function in ADS5, somehow like this. It has 1 and 2 with this horizon action. And if I compare that with this particle dynamics, right, so here's the partition function of the heavy quark, they're very, very similar in form. And literally going through exactly the same steps as you use to derive Brownian motion from the partition function of a particle, you can derive Brownian motion of a string. Okay, so going through exactly the same steps, you find these equations of motion. You find that the bulk equation of motion for the string, which is supposed to be what it is, you find this horizon theorem, dissipation theorem, horizon boundary condition, where this is some random term, and we'll talk about that in just a second. And then you have this Neumann boundary conditions, which is saying that at the edge of the string, you shouldn't have any bending. Okay. So let me summarize a little bit here on what the physics consequences of those terms are, how that works. All right, so summary. So as was sort of anticipated, okay, you get here, still you have this, at the horizon, you have this boundary condition. You have a tension, which is pulling you upwards, okay? You have the random force, which is pulling you in some random direction, and you have the drag, and the three are all balanced, okay? So the motion is still overdamped there at the horizon, okay? And this random force obeys this fluctuation dissipation theorem like this. Okay. And more general relation is like that when you go to high frequency. Okay. So now we have this horizon boundary condition, and I'd like to just say in picture sort of what it does. Okay. So I'm going to draw this part. Yeah.
So there was a step where you said, given the motivation, I can guess this form.
Right.
But you had derived it. Can you give us a flavor for
Yes. that? I mean, I'd like to, I'll do that next. I mean,
Okay.
The new derivation of it,
okay.
Which I think is transparent, much more transparent than the original paper. Okay. Maybe I just state the consequences of this, this horizon term first, and then we can. And so what we find. So now you have this horizon. Okay, so if I go back. So now you just have to go solve. You have your equations of motion. It's these ones, right? And you have this stochastic term at the horizon, which then leads to stochastic motion in the bulk, okay? And so let's, I wrote here, summarize this part. I now switch to the board a little bit to sort of explain it. All right, so consequences. Okay, so here's our string. Here's our string. It looks like this. Okay, and here's the endpoint of the string. And so first of all, after analyzing this thing correctly, we find the string obeys the right equation of the motion. Okay. Or at least the endpoint obeys the Langevin equations, which is what you would have hoped for. You also find, okay, so now I go solve for the string inside of this geometry. Right? So the string here comes, and I go solve for the string. So let me draw some pictures here. Okay, so what you find is that the string is just a function of time and r. It's given by vt. At least for not very long times, it's given by a functional form, this trailing string. Okay, and this is the same. It is. So the velocity for a typical thermal particle is small. It's a very small number. So the velocity close to equilibrium is order square root of the temperature of the mass of the quark. Okay. And since the mass of the quark is very large, right, the typical velocity is very, very small. Okay. And so in particular, this velocity here is a very small number. And the amplitude of this average, I drew it way too large, okay? It's actually much smaller than that, right? It's a very small number. And the amount of bending from straight is actually a small number. Is that okay? So, and in particular, you should just be maybe clear how small, okay? So, if I put in what is the mass of the quark, what you see is it's not only is it small by a number, which I call Rm, it's actually small by lambda to the 1/4. So it's actually a tiny bending. Okay, so it's actually almost straight up to this power of lambda 1/4. Right, so this whole picture that I'm going to draw is of order 1 over lambda 1/4 t. Okay. All right. So that's just the if I look at this first term, the quark is moving with some velocity. Yeah. Then this first term just describes the average trailing string. So a quark is moving, and it's trailing behind it a string, which was worked out previously, right? That's this average motion. Now, in addition to that random bit, right, there's this noise bit, right, C. right? And that's a random string, and it has the same functional form. And so every time, you know, it's a random thing, so every time you look at it, it fluctuates around the average. So this would be time 1, time 2, time 3, okay, like that. And those are these quantum fluctuations. And you can actually estimate, I won't do it here, but you can estimate this amplitude of those things. And the amplitude, okay, squared delta x square root is actually 1 over lambda, just simply 1 over lambda 1 quarter, 1 over t. Okay, so actually, if you look at this in this heavy quark limit, you find that those quantum fluctuations are actually large compared to the average itself. Okay, so you see this in this very slow limit, which is the typical thermal limit, the thing is nearly straight, and then you have this quantum fluctuations of the string, which oscillate every time step you look at it. Okay, now you got a very clear picture, right, of why you get a random force in the boundary theory. Okay, so you have this string, and every time you look at it, it jumps from one position to another position to another position, and each time it's pulling in the direction of the string. Right, so this time it's pulling it here and pulling it there and pulling it there, and each time you look at it, it's pulling the quark in a random direction. Okay, which leads to this random force in the boundary theory. All right. So I go on and sort of give the picture of how you might derive this Hawking radiation, unless there's other questions about that. Okay. All right. So now I came to say that was a little bit old now, and I want to just quickly, in the last 10 minutes here, sort of summarize how you might derive this Hawking radiation using a somewhat different language than what people have done in the past. So let's see that up here. Okay. All right, so let me give here how it works. Okay, so here was our string. Here's our world. Here's the string. And here is this stretched horizon, which is 1 plus epsilon. And, okay, and so there are quantum fluctuations down here, which then propagate upwards like that. And it's those upward propagation of those things which is supposed to give rise to this Hawking flux. Okay. Now, if I look at this this form of, you know, so what are we trying to derive here? Okay, so we're trying to derive this horizon effective action. Okay, fortunately, it's still written there. Okay, and we're asking what is the symmetrized two-point functions at the horizon. Okay, so it's clear then if I have some statistical fluctuation down there, then these will propagate up and lead to a statistical fluctuation up at this stretched horizon. So I need to use my knowledge of the statistical fluctuation inside of this 1 plus epsilon to derive the statistical fluctuation at this 1 plus epsilon. Okay. Now, I'm not going to do that because it takes it too far afield, but I'll quote the result. Okay. So the point is that this GRR horizon of omega turns out to be related to the statistical fluctuation in the bulk by sort of a boundary limit, okay, of the statistical fluctuation in the bulk. Okay, so you have to calculate So then our goal, let me put here 1 and 2. Okay. So our goal is to calculate this statistical propagator in the bulk. And then if I take the limit that I go to the horizon with these derivatives, I can determine the statistical correlator on the horizon. Okay. Now,
those not at equal time.
They're not at equal time, no. No. But they are at equal, well, they're at equal horizon, they are at equal radius when you finally evaluate it. They're finally evaluated both here. Right. Okay. So same different times, but same radius, right? But you have this derivative, right? You're taking sort of the derivative, which is derivatives like just right here, kind of here and there. Mm-hmm. Right? It's very analogous, actually, somehow to ADS-CFT, that you can have propagators in the bulk, and you lift them up into the boundary, and that tells you about propagators in the boundary theory, okay? And this is very analogous to that. Okay. So what do I know about this statistical propagator in the bulk theory? I know some things. Okay. So let's discuss this thing. Okay. If I have a massless scalar field theory, I mean, these fluctuations are kind of a field living in 1+1 dimension, right? And they're massless. So if I have a massless scalar field theory in 1+1 dimensions in flat space, just flat space, then I know how to compute this fluctuation in 1+1 dimensions, free massless scalar field. It turns out to be minus 1 over 4 pi log like that. All right, it's a you can just use free massless scalar field, just go calculate that thing. It's got to be a logarithm. What's slightly unusual about the statistical propagator is the statistical propagator is real. Okay, that's the important characteristic of it. It's a real thing. And so you have to have there the absolute values. Okay. And you can just go ahead and calculate that in 1+1 dimension for a massless field. Okay. All right. So now, so that's for a massless field. So the point would be like this. Let's look at our geometry. So here's our, I'm going to draw here 1 plus epsilon way up high, and here's 1. Okay. Now I look at this string in there. Okay. I also switch coordinates, sorry. Okay. Turns out to be, I use this Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. I hope that's V is, this is Eddington-Finkelstein time. It's kind of time. For no good reason, okay? The only reason why I switched is because I did these two calculations at different moments in time. Okay, so, all right. So that's the metric I'm going to use. And so if I look at this statistical propagator, that underlying thing there, in these coordinates, what do I know about it? I would claim that we know something about it, okay? So I have this statistical propagator, G sim. It's a function of two coordinates, R1, V1, and R2, V2. Okay. So V is like the time, basically, for any fixed radius, this is the time. Now, the point is, when R1 and R2, when R1 and V1 approaches R2 and V2, the correlator is very, very close in space, right? So at that point, I must recover the flat space result, right? The two points are close, so close in space, I must get back to this free result of the massless 1 plus 1 ideal gas. So we know that when R1V1 goes to R2V2, then G sim goes to minus 1 over 4 pi, and here I put in a k, I talk about it in a second, the same result, log of A that. And k is the difference in normalization of the action. I mean, my action in this case was canonically normalized, and in general you will have a different normalization. So for k is defined like this. So the action would be k times integral of 1/2 squared. Now, for the string in this bulk, this, you know, the string action is a classical object. It has a large action, right? And so this k for the string is root lambda. It's proportional to root lambda. Okay. So that agrees with what we said. I mean, the statistical fluctuations of the classical string are small. They're suppressed by this power of the large action. Okay, so we know that the statistical propagator obeys that. Okay, now last result here. So now we have to work out the equations of motion, which propagate the Green's function from here down there in the bulk up to the boundary, right? So you know what the equations, you know, the Dyson equations of those propagators are, and you know that this G sim obeys the Schwinger-Dyson equations. So So how do I propagate this from this down there in the bulk up to the horizon? Well, I have my Schwinger-Dyson equations of motion, which apply to this Green's function. Okay, so, and in this coordinates, looks like this. Zero. Okay. Now you also have a similar equation for, and also R2 and V2. So you have two equations which are supposed to solve, tell you how to propagate your symmetrized Green's function from any place in space and time to any other place in space time. Now, let me just mention one point here. What's important there is that the symmetrized Green's function, unlike all the other ones, like the Feynman and the retarded propagator and all that, they obey the homogeneous equation. So all the other ones, they obey, have a delta function there on the other side. So the symmetrized one is special in that the homogeneous, because basically it's chronological minus anti-chronological, so you get zero. Okay? So, all right. So now you can go. Now you can go and try and solve this set of propagation equations in this background. Okay, I'm going to write down the solution, and then we sort of talk about the meaning of it. This we don't need anymore. Maybe we have more. So let me just qualitatively describe the solution of these equations, these kind of equations. So qualitatively, it looks like this. Okay. So here's the space. I draw time running this way. And here's R1. And here's this stretched horizon at 1 plus epsilon. And I also draw all of these radial outgoing geodesics close to the black hole horizon. So all of these radial outgoing geodesics look somehow like this. More and more, like that. And then I write down the solutions. Turns out you can go solve those equations, find the solution. Turns out that gsim is some function of the initial data times R1 minus 1 e to the minus 2 pi t V1 R2 minus 1 V2. Okay. So what is this? Let me just sort of say. So this says the argument, this argument is constant along outgoing radial geodesics. And this is determined by the initial data. Yeah. This function. I mean, you have to specify the initial conditions in order to evolve it. And so what you see is that since this function is constant at long time outgoing radial geodesics, all in this region, yeah, all along this correlation, this correlation can be determined way in the past, right? In particular, if I cross back way back here, yeah, that's the only initial data which is relevant. I mean, all other initial data is going to eventually disappears and is irrelevant. So at late times, the only initial data that was important was this. Okay. Only important. And what you see here, because of all those congruences of those geodesics, right, they're all determined extremely close to the horizon, right? All close together and all extremely close to the horizon. And so you can, you know what the answer needs to be close to that horizon, okay, at this initial data. So you actually know that this function is determined precisely by that logarithm, all right? And so after that, you know, some more work, you say that this gsim must have the following form. Log of R1 minus 1 minus at late times, it must have that form, regardless of where you started. Okay. All right. So now you know this gsim in the bulk. Okay. It's just a matter, and there's some maybe. It's actually another few things here I didn't write, but okay. Now, I know it in the bulk. I know this gsim. It's a function of R1 and R2 and V1 and V2, right? And I can go back to my horizon action this formula up there, right, and plug in gsim and differentiate twice and get what the effective horizon action should be. Okay, and so I'll make a long story short, you get the right answer. You get the right answer. So, you know, differentiating here, gsim or horizon in time ends up being constant minus And this turns, this is actually the Fourier transform of what was this supposed to be. Okay, so after you sort out the coefficients, do the Fourier transform carefully, turns out it is exactly that function. Okay. All right, So that's anyway how you could derive that. It's all about, you know, roughly speaking, you have this logarithmic correlation which comes from pair production. You have then outgoing radial geodesics which determine all of the future correlations on this stretched horizon, and you just exactly get basically this is what these are the words that Hawking uses. It's not the formulas he somehow writes down, but those are the words. Okay, exactly the words. Okay. Okay, so now I bring my conclusions here. Okay, so we studied this quantum mechanics in ADS-5, leads to thermal noise. We studied this prototypical motion example, Brownian motion. Other fields, of course, fluctuate, with like dilaton and graviton, other things. Maybe there's some fun applications there from ADS-CFT. I gave a different derivation of Hawking flux that appeals to my physical nature, okay? And I like it. And in particular, I know how to extend this. I didn't really use frequencies at all, okay? I used time, everywhere time. And never was there a mixture of modes in Fourier space, which no one knows what it means exactly. It's all in time and solving ordinary partial differential equations. And so I know how to extend this derivation to non-equilibrium geometries, so when black hole is forming and so on. There's some nice prototypes in ADS that you can work with, so I'll stay tuned about that. And so I start to see what I was always hoping for from ADS is this fluctuation dissipation theorem. I mean, you always need in thermal equilibrium a balance between the noise and the drag, and we start to really see it. You have gravity pulling you down and fluctuations coming out, and the two balance each other. And it's that balance which is, you know, which is the fluctuation dissipation theorem. Okay, thanks.
Any other questions?
Almost zero density, right?
Zero density, yeah.
Do you know if you can establish this Brownian motion
I think so, and I mean, I also think that this would be interesting to work out the Hawking radiation in that case, because basically what happens, should happen, is that you have a charged black hole here. There's an electric field, okay? So different plus and charges, negative charges, have different motion in this near horizon geometry, and that should give you the statistical weights with the chemical potential vectors, right? And so I think you should be able to. Right. Plausible.